substance equals spurn. The propaganda's a win, stress feeding on my tension. My countrymen, they love their fiction. Where's Parnell? It's made with good intentions.
Good morning. Welcome back to 1 of 200, the Aotearoa Politics Media Podcast. You're here with your host. I'm Philip. Kyle's away. He's been thrown in jail for worker exploitation and withholding our wages as hardworking take mongers in the take mines. As well as Philip, we have PMAX. How are you doing?
Kia ora, doing well. About to make my pilgrimage today to the Costco in Auckland. Pay respect to the spectre of a third member of our supermarket ecosystem.
A vengeful consumer as a god pilgrimage. And as well as PMAX, we have Simone. How are you doing?
Good morning, Auckland. You know, scratching eczema feels so good when you don't have a GP in your ear telling you not to do it. I'm doing okay. I have a really long commute right now, so because I'm still working in Hamilton. But, you know, it's just life. C'est la vie. I wish Tiwia would get its shit together and have like an actual commuter service that could go both ways and or run more than like once a day, question mark. So,
bullet trains, baby. Let's go.
And not take 2.5 hours. I don't know how the infrastructure in this country is so bad. Like, how do you have a train service that's averages 40 kilometers an hour? Nobody knows.
Just walk. That's, yeah, exactly right. Well, welcome. Welcome to Auckland. You're resplendent in your new Tamaki Makaurau environs.
This is an audio medium, but for some reason my camera's decided to turn everything pink looking, and I don't know why.
It's given Simone a kind of soft pink energy halo that we can only assume will translate to much softer takes, mostly involving being kind to everyone, a politics of Jacinda-esque kindness.
That's right.
Today's episode, unfortunately. All right, so to start off with everyone's favorite time of the day as a kid, school lunches first thing in the morning, 9 a.m. school lunch, as we all hoped and dreamed for as kids in the who wanted to be in the playground while doing sustained silent reading at 9 a.m. on a whatever morning it was. PMAX, can you give us a quick update on the shenanigans that have been occurring with our famed school lunch success story, hashtag David Seymour forever. Let's go.
Yeah. So those of us who have been paying close attention to the school lunches will notice that one of the largest suppliers of school lunches has gone into liquidation. Now, I believe the official line on this is a good thing because it shows that the problem's being exposed. But most people are well aware that a company's going into liquidation is generally not a positive sign. This was one of the largest subcontractors of Compass Group, and it's just really kind of showing that the system itself is not even sustainable. It can't even keep up halfway through a school term before collapsing in on itself. And, you know, personally, just to spitball a bit further, I think it really shows that the whole design of this revamped school lunch system was flawed from the beginning by shuffling that money away from local communities into a international company famed for failure. And now, latest I've read, we are importing our lunches from Western Australia for, I assume, cost efficiency purposes.
Yeah, there's one thing that Western Australia is famously good at. It's logistics and cuisine. I think are the two main things we associate with the extravagant outlands of Perth. Definitely not any kind of Mad Max-esque cannibalistic wasteland associations there, so nothing to be overly concerned about. And yeah, as you say, the Labelle have died, which is quite cute. But yeah, I mean, the stuff that's been coming out in the last week has really kind of heightened the story, in as much as it's kind of a rolling maul of pain for the government and their kind of comms choices to minimize and try to not take responsibility. Have you taken any kind of do you find it interesting at all the kind of political footsie between the Minister of Education and David Seymour and the Prime Minister kind of answering questions in different ways and trying to palm things off to each other. Like, do you think that's a sign that it's got enough purchase now that no one wants to really stand full-throatedly behind the delivery of it? Even David Seymour, who says, oh, you know, it's good that this minor player has died because we can solve these problems in the perfect kind of free market of efficiency. Or is it bad that it shows that they're really not planning on solving anything?
Marketplace of food ideas.
Yeah. I think ultimately the play from the government is going to be, and this is just me sort of maybe astrally projecting into the future, perhaps not, is they're going to get to budget 2025 and say, look, there's just simply not enough money in the budget to get these lunches going out. You know, people were unhappy with them, so we're just going to scrap them all together. Maybe with some kind of like means-tested tax credit for single mothers who have 3 effective years of study left, and student loans under $15,000. There'll be some kind of like tax credit that they have to wait on the phone for 10 years to see, would be my sort of guess, given the trajectory this government is on. I don't think there's enough shame among the coalition, where if they were faced, well, you promised to do school lunches, where are they now? That they would sort of admit failure on that sort of response. I know the funding was approved. Wait, was the funding approved for like 3 years or something? I do need to look at that legislation again. Regardless, I think they're just going to try and can the whole thing because it is a pile of shit at the moment and it's increasingly stinky. And whoever ends up being the person taking the blame for that is going to be not looking too hot. We've got that sort of interesting, I haven't been following too closely. I know that Erica Stanford was attempting to organize meetings with David Seymour, and David Seymour was saying, oh, sorry, my coffee date went a little bit over, can't make the meeting. And, you know, they're doing the typical media avoidance of, oh, you know, the meeting wasn't to discuss the failure of school lunches. It was a general catch-up meeting. School lunches are just part of the agenda, but it's becoming increasingly clear that David Seymour just has absolutely no respect for his coalition partners. And I suspect that given that New Zealand First has also been not showing the highest level of respect, they've both made clear to National that, hey, if you displease us, we're just going to sink the government, force a re-election. So, yeah, just play ball. Sorry, kind of rambling there, but I think ultimately they're going to try and kill it. And both of them are going to play footsie on trying to push blame for it onto the other party. I honestly don't know what David Seymour's argument would be as to how his amazing system has failed so spectacularly, given that he's headlined it and claimed it all. But media have let him get away with much more heinous crimes in the past. So yeah, I wouldn't put it past them somehow shifting the blame onto National.
Yeah, totally agree. Well, that's, you know, that's what he'll try to do next term when it's still not working after he said it'll be fine by next term. And, you know, worst comes to worst, they just pay more and more on a kind of ad hoc basis as the costs blow out and become as expensive or more expensive than the previous program. And after they promise to cover more people, because already what at least one school's opted out, which, you know, that's how you save money, right? Just make the service so crap and the delivery so crap that people say, look, it's honestly, it's easier for us to just not have to deal with this bureaucratic nightmare. We're spending, what, $1,500 I saw, I think one school said, per week on time for teachers and, you know, in-house kind of sanitation and delivery and picking stuff up and dropping it off and disposing of waste and handing out meals and waiting for them to cool down so your students aren't harmed to a, you know, hospital ward degree. So yeah, at some point it's easier if you just say, well, if you just stop kicking us every week, it's actually better to be to just let these kids go hungry and not learn anything and join the school to prison pipeline, which,
yeah,
you know, that's the alternative we're talking about here, right?
Well, it's curious that it's Huntley, which is very close to Spring Hill, isn't it? I mean, you couldn't come up with a better metonym, could you?
It's efficient.
It's efficient. It's so much more efficient when the pipeline is right there. When it's a short pipeline.
It's localism, Simone. That's lucky
Yeah,
it's done
that's
right.
right. The provincialism of the school to pipeline. We need to internationalize it.
That's what we were promised. No more of this woke, nationalized Three Waters efficiency. It's all about just stay local, stay in your community, local provision of services like lifelong prison infrastructure. Ugh, glim, grim.
It
I knew
is
what you were saying,
funny.
gloom and grim.
I was, thank you.
It is funny how the government sort of flips between we're investing in provincial areas, we're investing in communities and so forth. They literally have their community investment fund, I forget what the name of it is, Nicola Willis's baby. But then they've got policies like the school lunches policy, which is just a thinly veiled excuse to send money overseas.
Yeah, and I mean, it was definitely part of their kind of rebranding exercise last year, right? I went back and looked at some of the headlines from last year as the school lunch project was being and kind of reformed, and will it be, how much will be pulled back, how much will be cut? They were never really clear about it early on. And then the kind of most of the kind of establishment media voices, with some notable exceptions, to be fair, were pretty keen to jump all in the tank and not dig underneath the surface when David Seymour came out with his $3 lunch lie, let's say. And they just kind of ran along with it and said, can we do cheaper for better? Yes, we can. All the really kind of mainstream voices did that. There were people who actually kind of run numbers more for a living, like Max Rashbrook and, the kind of progressive economist sect. Who were quite good on it and were always saying, well, can we at least see how you propose to do this thing that most school lunch providers even say can't be done? And I think this just shows another instance of kind of shallow media transcription of press releases where, One News and Herald and some RNZ people and some Stuff people would just, print ACT press releases, as we've been saying for years, and say, look, we're doing more for cheaper. We're actually going to provide lunch to more kids. Take that, woke lefties. It's actually better now. And yeah, not dig even slightly beneath the surface to, for
Yeah.
example, just ask about the tendering process. How did you make this decision? Like, what does this company's record look like? Have they been able to deliver these kind of projects on time, on budget, at successful kind of margins? What are the KPIs like in the past? Like,
Yeah.
basic kind of questions that you'd think any kind of functioning two-eyed, two-eared, not to be ableist human would have kind of asked, right? And it is wild to me that that kind of due diligence wasn't
Well,
followed.
and the allowance of the rhetoric shift without, I mean, we're seeing pushback, but we're seeing pushback now because the public at large are aware of how fucking miserable these lunches are, and how that was not the case last year, where that rhetoric shift from we're going to do these lunches cheaper for better, and then now to oh, if you're not happy with the lunches, just get a Marmite sandwich in you to, yeah. I mean, currently now, where it's failure is good actually, because it shows us where the problems are.
But I'm sure that before the Marmite sandwich comment, they would have done some courier polling and got some numbers about how many New Zealand voters, how many national voters, how many ACT voters support the idea of providing public school lunches at all, right? Because you have to be planning if you're a kind of centre-right government that's strategically disestablishing public goods, you have to do it in a strategic order. And the problem is that Christopher Luxon's a terrible salesman, right? He can't make the argument. So I've no doubt in my mind that John Key could have, delivered a better version of that line that would have resonated with the talkback sect and the kind of One News establishment sect enough to have 55% of voters on board with the idea that actually providing school lunches, public school lunches at scale is a waste. And we really need something targeted, probably in partnership with Tangata Whenua, where like actually it's communities can provide for themselves at a much smaller scale, much more efficiently. So instead of having any kind of mass school lunch program based on schools, we have this efficient new community organization called something something, and they come in and, bring seven school lunches to a to a school, and if the poor kids show up, great. Yeah, you know, that kind of thing, right? And just a
Yeah.
bit more subtly. But they're just not good at this, right? They're bad at this whole project.
Yeah, and I think part of it is like a lack of awareness about the economic conditions that they've created, where, like, I mean, I think it was potentially smart of the coalition in a sort of cold Machiavellian way to lay off so many public servants. Because, you know, I mean, I'm sure the numbers would reflect that that's also like a significant income stream for left-wing parties in terms of donations from well-off public servants.
That's probably what 70% of the Green Party voter base.
Yeah, but
Sorry.
the problem is those public servants come from all walks of life, but predominantly are coming from wealthier families and backgrounds. And, you know, the economy is not getting better. There are fewer and fewer jobs. Businesses are shutting down like crazy. There was like a cafe in Wellington that had something like 2,000 applications for a single opening or something ridiculous. That might be hyperbole. But it means that even communities and groups and individuals who are usually quite insulated from economic shocks are like, oh, damn, so and so's niece got. She's lost her job. She hasn't found a new job. Like the quote unquote hardworking New Zealanders are struggling to find jobs. And thankfully, most people are intelligent enough to put one and two together and be like, oh, fuck. Those people that I usually have a lot of lack of respect for, they might be struggling to find jobs in this economy. How are they going to feed their kids? I feel like it's sort of a very poorly timed comment. If this was like in the short COVID boom after COVID, where there was that like economic happy times, then sure, I think you could probably get away with the Marmite comment without too much complaint. But in these economic times, where there is a lot of uncertainty around employment, a lot of uncertainty around literally putting food on the table, yeah, I just think it's a complete dud line to run.
There should be a law where every time a politician in power, like Luxon, says something like the Marmite line, everybody gets to vote on whether or not he should have to live on Marmite sandwiches for a year. There should just be a thing where it's like if enough people,
Yeah.
think that, somebody's like, oh, I don't see anything wrong with benefit sanctions or anything like that. It's like, okay, we're putting you on the benefit for a year and you have to hop, skip, and a jump, and your case manager is shitty.
This is a complete aside, but it's like
That's sorry, that's
with.
like a really Reddit sort of solution.
I know, but
It's funny.
I think public servant remuneration should all go through what is it, the remuneration authority that the MPs like their pay is managed by, where they're just like, oh, this independent authority said we deserve a 10% pay rise, guess we'll take it. All public servants should be under that, like, you know, maybe reduce the amount of union bargaining that's going on, but making sure that everyone gets paid in accordance with their levels of work and so forth, and not just
Yeah, we've
levels of
just
power.
objectively looked at the numbers and determined that we deserve 10% above inflation.
Yeah.
It's only
So it's a
fair.
really funny thing when they're like, no, I can't take the extra bump from like, $300,000 to $310,000. I'm donating it to charity. It's like,
Yeah.
oh, very big of you.
Yeah.
And you're
I
announcing
will
this in the news?
yeah.
Wow. Doing it so quietly.
I will be claiming tax back on those donations. Those will be tax refundable donations, but I will be donating it.
I'm
Also,
donating it to the Hillary Clinton Foundation.
yeah, exactly. That charity, ladies and gentlemen, the National Party Foundation.
That's right. That's right. The one that's in my name. No, wait, wasn't there a Labour person who did that in the last term or something? Just
Amazing.
very funny whenever they do that. And people are like, wow, they're so giving.
Well, I mean, National Party people do it too. Like the
Oh, of course.
early John Key myth about donating all of his income to charity that was never, checked or at any point really fact-checked. But
Yeah.
he said it in passing once or something when he ran in 2008, and people just carried that myth on for as long as he was prime minister. Like people at the pub that I talked to would be like, "Did you know that he donates his entire?" And I was like,
Yeah.
"Where did you read that? Can you show
But
me like one source?" And no, it's the
not
vibe.
only that, it's like so he doesn't need it to look because he's very
I know.
rich, like because he owns his own vineyard where from which he gave a bottle of wine to the women that he sexually assaulted.
Well,
Is this
He's only got $50 million, Simone. It's nice of him to.
Yes. When you're on the board of ANZ, you can give away 200K or whatever.
Okay. Let's roll on. We start before we got well off track. No apologies. We were starting to hit kind of the bigger kind of economic / comms-y vibes-y things, and I really look. I'll level with you, audience. I really wanted to talk about the infrastructure summit today, but I've read everything that I can find about it, and it is the most boring, nothing shit. So really all I have to say is that, what a damn squib. Like, clearly for the last few weeks, the National Party was really, or Luxon and Willis especially, were really pinning their hopes on a vibes change from this infrastructure summit. And I do not see that coming. Even the media, you know, the Cochlins and the Walls of the world, who would love nothing more than to talk about how exciting it is that we have a brand new dawn for our economy, and like foreign money is pouring in like the wave through the elevator doors in The Shining, are not saying that, right? Like, there's nothing. This is a hollow, like absolute nothing that just kind of came and went in the night, and like, this is not going to be referred to again. In 1 week, people will have completely forgotten that this happened, and they've spent a huge amount of time trying to make this a thing. So I really like, it's not going to change the polling trajectory, which is bleak for this government, and people just recognizing the kind of international trajectory of what's going on in the world, like the geopolitics, the hard kind of real geopolitical environment is going to hit, and this kind of infrastructure, quote unquote infrastructure summit of what, by the way, right? Like, there's a real kind of I don't know, mask being thrown up here is not gonna hide anything, which is amazing. Like, I really thought the establishment kind of consensus was enough bought and paid for, that the promise of foreign capital would kind of make some headlines. But if anything, I think Labour, with their pretty anemic, like, no privatising hospitals, schools and prisons announcement, is kind of the biggest thing that's come out of this entire, you know, festival for millionaires, which is weird, right? Like, is that a vibe shift or is that just me? I don't know. Maybe I'm too kind of black-pilled on this
stuff.
I've seen
a lot of the, you know, centrist accounts and stuff on Twitter seem to have turned on PPPs a bit, which is curious. Like, that's not something that we've seen that much before, so I do think so. Also, it's really funny that you said, we're not really going to talk about this, and then proceeded to talk about it. but I do agree. I mean, it was, who announced it? Was it Edmonds? Barbara Edmonds. And that is quite a change. I mean, well, somebody tell the Labour leadership that actually, you know, so they can get the left hand to agree with the right hand, because of course we just had Hipkins sort of saying, oh, you know, we're not really going to change that much from National. But, you know, if this stuff, I mean, I'm curious as to whether or not what they really mean is, you know, nothing will be taken further, the ratchet won't be pulled further, because that is what Labour always does. Or whether or not what they mean is, we are going to undertake the significant work that it takes to reverse what has happened since the 90s in respect of the health sector, in respect of our infrastructure, or the 80s for our infrastructure. And I'm quite curious as to whether or not they put their money where their mouth is, because to do all of that would require upfront making our significantly changing our debt to GDP ratio, which is really low for the OECD. New Zealand does not borrow nearly enough for its future to then have it be paid off. And so therefore everything just consistently gets degraded over time in this country, which we see everywhere. You can point to almost anything, aside from, of course, the vast amounts of wealth that are funneled up toward consultancies and ad firms and other sources of, you know, the mates of the whatever governing party is in power, right? You know, the immense inefficiency of that. And that is, of course, you know, the greatest inefficiency of the public service. We have, by and large, an efficient public service if looking purely at the public service, but its most inefficient parts are where it is just a money for mates program, where there is this kind of corporate welfare. They're just sort of handing money hand over fist to consultancies and so forth, or outside IT firms, and all of the useless dross that comes from that, right? Because we don't have any of the stuff in-house, or we refuse to build those contingencies. And I think it might be becoming clear, this is perhaps too hopeful to even Labour, that's not future-proofed. With how much geopolitics is changing constantly, you can't rely on saying, okay, well, everything's just going to be, you know, Microsoft forever. It's like, will the United States exist in 5 years? We don't know. So even though it is likely that it will, there's a lot that's happening that suggests that in some way, these alignments are changing, these arrangements are changing, the European Union is pivoting. The UK is a total black box of torment nexus at the moment. We don't know what's going to happen with those geopolitical relationships. Everything's thrown up in the air. I mean, people are talking about whether or not, you know, you shouldn't have some kind of Kanzuk, you know, sort of economic alliance, some version of the EU that's based on, like, you know, your ancestors having eaten paste and got thrown in a ship and taken to Australia, whatever it was, you know, like basically the racism coalition, right, of settlers.
But particularly racists with bad food. It's the bad food racists.
It's so funny to be like, yes, we are having like a kind of ethno state settler collective. We're going to be racists. Who's the master race? Fucking Poms.
The worst one.
the superior race of the world, as we all know, are people who go to Ibiza and get sunburned.
And never even discovered paella, the most obvious food in the world. It's embarrassing. It's embarrassing. Anyway, yeah, I mean,
it's beautiful.
The geopolitics of it is quite fascinating, eh? Like, it's the I guess the allowability of what they see as kind of foreign investment, you know, that if they just want to exist in the 2000s forever, this kind of political class, and it, like, yeah, I don't know, maybe we are being too rosy eyed with the thinking that I don't want to say that Labour's turned a corner, but I think they wouldn't have been, or they their finance spokesperson, or, you know, Grant Robertson wouldn't have been as strident about this as this. As Brad Edmonds has been about hospitals, schools, and prisons. And I mean, I totally agree with you that, like, when she says hospitals, schools, prisons, and critical infrastructure should be non-negotiable, publicly delivered, no PPPs, like, that doesn't mean unwinding the billions and billions and billions of dollars and probably years of time it would take to unwind multiple Labour governments' investment in those projects in the past and get us back to closer to a kind of social democratic vision. But, like, even as is, looking forward, like, especially considering this juncture that we're at with the kind of flim-flammery of Web3 and AI being pitched in every fucking, you know, every RFP is just, you know, undeliverable lies based on Web3 nonsense,
oh,
right?
Yeah.
So especially at this point, I think it's quite, like, it's important that the Social Democratic Party take that stand. That's, you know, it's a bare minimum, but it's honestly, it's more than I would have expected. And it is going to be interesting to see if and how that kind of remains a line. And maybe we can bring, I wanted to talk about tariffs as well. So let's bring this in at that point. As you're saying, Simone, like, on the global stage, the uncertainty is off the charts, right? And, you know, the obvious kind of, not even the elephant in the room, because everyone's talking about it, is Trump's, you know, constant lying about whether he's going to do something or not. You never know if he's going to suddenly throw a tariff on something, or usually not, right? He's usually going to back down on whatever he'd lied about the previous day. So you can't really take anything he says at face value or at any value whatsoever. You just have to treat him as an unreliable actor and factor that in ahead of time. And I think the most prudent way, as especially a small state, to act in this kind of global turbulence is by A, building up, say, capacity, because that's at least something we have onshore that we can deal with the next few decades with, right? Like, A, Ministry of Works, like, that should have already happened, but this is, like, you know, second best time to plant trees today, right? Let's do that. And then B, like, a sensible independent foreign policy based on bilateral relationships.
I believe in a sensible foreign policy, actually.
Sensible, just common sense, I think, Simone, would be great. But, like, you know, acknowledging that we're part of the Pacific would be a good start, and kind of dealing with Pacific Islands as neighbors rather than, like, subsidies.
Well, common sense. So Winston Peters, the common sense candidate who's against wokeness. Yeah, that's right. Sorry, what were you going to say, PMAX?
It was just, I think Green Party put forward a really good foreign policy idea on this, with, like, the Schengen zone, but for the Pacific Islands. which I think would be a big first step in sort of forming an independent foreign policy. While at the same time, there definitely needs to be some level of awareness that you've got to balance that with maybe a bit more observation on the predatory industries in New Zealand that take advantage of Pacific Island
Yeah, I was going to say
labor.
certainly, and not to intercut too much, but I'm quite skeptical of that, and I wonder if the Greens have thought it through. Because if we want to use these kinds of terms from Europe, we do have to look at the way that New Zealand would be the equivalent of a France, or better, a Germany within that sort of arrangement. And the way that Germany and the Troika, at its behest, essentially destroyed Greece is something we really have to be wary of, and something I think the Pacific Islands would be smart enough to look to as an example and say, I'm not quite sure about this. Not to say that the arrangements would be the same as would be allowed under that, but when you create these institutions, especially given that New Zealand is that kind of hyper-capitalist sort of society, I think you have to be quite wary of it. And in particular, the history of New Zealand's relationship with Nauru, with Niue, with other places in the Pacific, and is not only one of resource exploitation of, for example, stripping all of the phosphate out of Pacific Islands, but also of one involving literal slavery. You can look at the wealth of Chelsea Sugar was built by Blackbird, and was Pacific slaves were captured, kidnapped, and then shipped to New Zealand in our own version of the transatlantic slave trade, something which is not taught in schools. Like, say what you will about the United States, they know that their economy was built and their empire was built on slavery. New Zealand doesn't know. New Zealanders don't know
Hashtag not all
this.
schools. Hashtag not all schools.
I mean, it's good that certainly there's been a turn within the last few years, and I think the New Zealand History Teachers Association or something was talking about how we really need to, increase the understanding of these things in our history. And of course, there was the backlash to quote unquote wokeness for that basis, right? But
Well, and
this
even
is something that the majority of those kids don't vote. Do you know what I mean? Like.
even more recently, you've got incidents like the Dawn Raids, where Pacific labor that was brought over to meet labor shortages in New Zealand was then directly targeted on a racist basis, just to sort of, I don't know, boost votes for Muldoon. Well, also, who was the one before? Was it Kirk who started it? Rare Kirk L. I lose track of my ministers.
Actually, the
But
CIA got him because he wasn't woke enough. That's, I don't tell you that.
the sad thing about the whole situation is that New Zealand is the largest Pacific island, and ease of travel for islanders to both visit their families and connect with their families and have their families visit, and the economic opportunity that New Zealand presents is important, but there also needs to be awareness of maintaining the sovereignty of those islands, both economic and political, while also ensuring that the predatory practices in New Zealand aren't used to sort of exploit those people. So
Yeah,
it's a
absolutely.
rough one.
On a structural level, I think like that we shouldn't be emulating the EU. Like the EU is like, I think, pretty undeniably like
A failed organization.
a racist neocolonial construct that is kind of trying to create invisible walls around itself, and is going to continue to kill thousands and thousands of refugees that were created through its own economic and military decisions, and that's what it's there for at this point. Like, I think it's pretty undeniable. And even within it, as Simone was saying, like, you have the insane inequity and exploitation of Germany destroying the entire Greek economy as basically a lesson, right? We're in another situation, so they haven't done that. But yeah, like, just I think you're right. Like, Pacific Islands, non-New Zealand Pacific Islands would have to go into it with eyes wide open and understand like what they were getting into. And progressives in New Zealand who want this kind of thing, whether it's the Green Party or anyone else, need to be thinking down the track and separating those different aspects, like the immigration aspect, the free movement of capital, free movement of labor, things can be separate, right? And how those different countries relate to each other, maintaining sovereignty needs to be a thing. I mean, we've already seen that with the Cook Islands kind of arrogance in the last few. How little we respect even those kind of fig leaves of independence that we grant islands. And I am not enough of a New Zealand exceptionalist to think that there'd be a difference when a country that we have less kind of legal and historical ties to tries to make a similar choice in the future, right? So I don't think we could consider it analogous to either the EU or the Eurozone or Shenzhen, you know, but I think we do have to integrate more in the Pacific Island bloc as a kind of matter of necessity, and also with East Asia, right? Like there's basically economically no alternative.
Yeah, the Shenzhen zone.
Yes.
Oh, episode no. title just dropped.
Yeah, sorry, I was about to say that's the episode title.
This is right, and I had more things to say, and yet they've gone out of my mind because of Shenzhen zone.
That's gold. That's gold.
That's it really is a case of where the preconditions would have to be that New Zealand's economic structure is like our political economy is totally different, because the way that it currently works is everything is a wealth siphon up towards, as I say, those consultancy firms, the kind of resource extractors, the rent seeking extractive, you know, not even industry, it's just firms, I will say. And so it's worth considering that that would need to be totally flipped on its head, that for New Zealand to be a player within the Pacific, which doesn't seek to dominate, it would have to no longer be a settler colony, that you would have to have a tino rangatiratanga, that indigenous rulership would have to, and authority would have to be on top, with, you know, perhaps something suggested by the Matike Mai report, or, you know, some other kind of arrangement. In other words, parliament as it exists now wouldn't exist. The governor general wouldn't exist. We would not have, you know, any of that. And so that would have to be a first precondition. And secondly, I think you would need to begin with a project of reparations, where New Zealand is in a subservient position economically to a lot of these Pacific islands, where you have to give back more than has been extracted, so that they can have a starting position, which even makes sense. And it's difficult to see how this would work within a timeline of encroaching climate change and how that's affecting these Pacific Islands, because I think in many ways New Zealand is going to have to, and you know, as one of these larger Pacific Islands, is going to have to receive a lot of refugees, and people are going to have this huge cultural loss. And there's also this issue of the kind of cultural control and thought control really that's happened already through the kind of missionary colonization of the Pacific, and how that's radically changed how some indigenous populations in the Pacific view themselves, and also are primed essentially for white domination. These are all sort of issues which I think aren't easily addressed by the nice slogan of proposing a Schengen area. And I'm not trying to piss on the parade of the Green Party for once, but I do think it's worth considering and thinking through these thorny positions. And of course, I know that we expect Green parties and left parties and opposition parties always to have a higher standard than the right wing. You know, the news will always say, well, how are you going to pay for it? How are you going to pay for it? But in this case, given the history that's involved, it is worth slowing down and deeply thinking about what these solutions would be, and for people who are proposing this and or people who are trying to implement such policies, if they are part of a coalition agreement, to have deep consideration of where New Zealand needs to get its shit in order beforehand. And given that the Greens aren't actually socialist, I don't know if that's ever going to happen. There is significant resistance from the liberal factions who control much of the internal infrastructure, the kind of Shoreites, I suppose, to any kind of understanding of history, understanding of politics, or understanding of political economy as a cohesive project, and a material understanding of the world. They are inured to and immune from any kind of understanding. They're sort of inoculated from it, right, by liberalism, this kind of brain disease that stops you from looking and understanding causation from A to B, and simply thinking that everything is free-floating ideas. You know, the way that we stop racism is that you just wake your finger at people and give them workplace training. This kind of airy-fairy belief of the world as not as sort of some set of free-floating signs that don't actually exist or are not anchored to anything. This is a kind of brain disease that exists within the Green Party. And I'm quite skeptical that any of these people will have some kind of come to Jesus moment about really understanding anything about reality before they try to implement such things.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the fundamental you always need to get back to is the kind of political economic minimum bar that we'd need to have before any kind of those international arrangements, right? But even on a much lower basis, and you know, this isn't purely leftist position, but plenty of centre-leftist, centrists, even centre-right people, anyone who's not a kind of Trump acolyte, is pretty much agrees that multipolarity is happening, whether you like it or not, right? There's an expansion of the non-hegemonic kind of discourse that's happened by force since Trump's second Trump 2 MAGA. This time it's personal, has come back.
MAGA 2 electric boogaloo.
Yeah. Oof, if only if it was electric. It's a diesel boogaloo this time.
Whoops.
But yeah, I mean, it's just happening, right? So all of the multipolarity nerds who were decried as Putinites, I mean, they slash we were right? It's just that it's not happened by choice. It's happened because of kind of hard macroeconomic factors. Like tariffs is a big deal, whether they happen or not. Like even the threatening of tariffs forces nations to kind of shut down and internalize production. And maybe some of that kind of ethereal runoff, like discursive runoff, is partly the less than enthusiastic reaction to the investment summit that we brought up before. This kind of re-energizing of the concept of national capacity and internal capacity, that even the kind of, yeah, I guess runoff from Trumpian discourse always, as it does, kind of perversely filters through the kind of news machine and comes down into everyone's discourse, whether they like it or not. Many such cases, right? Bad food restaurant, you know, insert your Trumpian fave. But yeah, it is like it's
Shenzhen zone is very mad at me. That's okay. I'll still keep drinking that
I'll
garbage.
still keep drinking that garbage, yeah. But it's funny, right? Like I think even I think pre-Trump, this national government would have had a very different reaction to some of their attempts to kind of change the discourse and chuck some comms in that they love. And it's like, again, they can't meet the moment. They don't know who their audience is well enough. They don't have the talent to kind of sell what they're trying to sell. And I mean, even up until potentially joining Keir Starmer's Coalition of the Willing, that like disgustingly Blairite phrase in Ukraine, like they're out of step, they're out of time. Like they feel like they can't meet the moment no matter how much they try. It's just, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's good for us, right? On an electoral level, they're screwed. Even if, you know, it's insane that they're just handing any opposition easy wins. But I think that necessitates that we maintain a high bar for anyone that's not the government. Like that means that this Labour Party, this Green Party, this Te Pāti Māori need to meet the moment. Like they can't coast.
Winston Peters, Winnie P, he came to me, tears in his eyes. He said, you know, he had these whiskey bottles protruding from underneath his belt and his fancy dress pants. Very, very disrespectful. It's so disrespectful. They're not telling you that. I do think that one thing we should think about is, like you're saying, you know, it's, and this kind of flows on from it, it's easy to say things in opposition. And looking at the PPP matter again, the Triple P, you know, firstly, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. I think Hipkins and Edmonds are totally out of step with each other. When it comes time for government, guess who's going to win out over that? It's the one who is the right winger, right? Who's in power because he's on top. He's top dog because Labour's still running with Hipkins. And whether or not, you know, they end up that way, because I know that there's more of a committee-based approach rather than just, you know, one person says, you know, goes, unless their personality is kind of overbearing in some sense or Muldoon-like, you know, that it will be that. But like realistically, what's going to happen is that, right? One of them is going to win out. It's not going to be the person who's saying better things. But number two, while they are in opposition, it's easy to say things. And not only that, although at least they're saying things, but the time to try to force them to see how unpopular anything further right would be is now. Like the time to kind of say, if you want to win votes, you have to do good things is now. And I totally agree with you, Philip, in that respect. And you know, in all other respects, I co-sign everything you've ever said ever.
Oh no. Welcome to cancellation.
I'm handing it to David Seymour 10 times a year.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Well, yeah, you know, post Hipkins is delivery to the Auckland Business Council that I think we talked about last time. The formation of his little kind of economic clique I thought was interesting, right? Where he said Barbara Edmonds has this little team of like five or half a dozen relatively mid-low ranked kind of Labour MPs. They're the ones who are going to think about economics. The rest of you can, like, you know, get on with your portfolio.
The working groups are coming from inside the party. Oh, look, we're going to ignore these people now.
But, like, I thought that I'm not in the Labour Party, right? I don't have inside knowledge, but that seemed to maybe...
What?
I know, I'm sorry. I can only apologise.
Why are you as a white man not a member of the Labour Party? Get it together, sis.
So sorry.
And that's on period.
I'm sorry for being a man.
Fuck me.
Yeah, it's throwback. But I thought that maybe...
Sorry, keep going.
Maybe lent some insight into some factionalism, right? Because the people who are in that group are not the people that you would pick if you were going to look at portfolios and think which portfolios are the ones that are that kind of economic thought, you know, political economic strategy portfolios who you want to work together for the next 10 years. Like, they seem like people picked because of the people rather than portfolios, is what I'm saying. Like, trade wasn't there. There were some big... what was it? Investment? No, not investment. That got moved. I can't remember. There were a bunch of big names or, you know, higher ranked people on the more kind of economic portfolios that weren't thrown into that bucket. And that made me think, well, this is like a strange political choice, right? So they're throwing a group of people together to make Lord knows how important decisions, but for some reason they're announcing this group, and for some reason they need number 30 and 31 to be on that group instead of number whatever it is, 11 and 13, who have much higher ranked. The main one I remember is trade, right? Because there have been so many articles about tariffs. I was like, why on earth, like, as a small, as everyone says, you know, trading nation, we're export driven, blah blah blah, why would you not have that person involved in any kind of, like, you know, working group, even though the working groups are coming from inside the house at this point, as you say, Simone? Like, who on earth is more important than that? Like, why is... I don't know, Labour. I'm not here to try to fix you. You do you, boo.
They call it the Calvin Davis effect. The problem with the 2020s is that we used to have all these Davids, and now all we have are Chris's.
That is true. It's a regression.
Well, actually, no, don't bring back the Daves. We need a new white male name.
Return to Phillips. That's what I think.
Every party's going to be run by a Steve in 5 years' time.
Abel, stop it. We know you're listening. Chill out.
I can't wait till we
listen,
get Blake.
Listen, okay? Philip, barefoot is legal. The native birds, the birds of this country are the true natives. They're the true indigenous.
Oh, the unsung majority. Just
we're going to tax every medicine that's not homeopathy.
Freedom camping's back, baby. Let's go.
What we need is the like the generation of people who named their children after like Game of Thrones characters. So we just have like Khaleesi interrupted Drogon during question time.
The victims in one of the cases that I dealt with was a Khaleesi. But God, if that you know, everybody's not regretting their deeply. I mean, listen, we're regressing, and what we're going back to is naming kids Hermione.
Yes. In a reactionary turf turn,
First MP is going to name their child Hermione now.
Naming your children Hermione, but not because you're inspired by Harry Potter, but because of the specific transphobic nature of the name.
Yeah, I don't know if J.K. Rowling knows, but there was a Hedwig before, and very trans.
No. This is the Black Mold edition, though. This Hedwig is fully just transphobic.
Black Mold edition, Taylor's version. Sorry, that was like a 2023 tweet.
Right. Okay, before we go completely off the rails, we'll put more likely during... because of an entirely unrelated destruction of National Rail metaphor that I'm too lazy to make. Simone, do you want to talk about NHS England and why it's your perfect child and you don't want any harm to come to it?
One of the things about this topic, about which I know so much, of course, Philip, is that we've recently seen the UK Labour Party somehow being worse than every somehow being worse than the predictions that the left made. People were saying, don't vote for them. They're going to lie to you. They're just going to be centrists. Oh, no. Oh, no. Wes Streeting is standing up in Prime Minister's Question Time, or, you know, whatever the equivalent is. Sorry, whatever the under MP version is. I don't think he was acting at the time, so I'm not sure what it's called when they just have, like, the minister, you know, do the question time. But whatever that version of PMQs was in Westminster Parliament, and his big, you know, clapback line to the Conservatives was, we are more right-wing than you, and we are succeeding at everything that you couldn't do in 14 years. Look at us destroy this country. We're more militarized than ever. We are going to genocide disabled people. We are going to destroy all of the health infrastructure of this country and sell it off. Look how bad we can be. We're better at being Tories than you are. And that was his big applause line. And there are these smug front bench Labour MPs, like I think maybe Thornberry was there in view of the camera, just like mugging away, just smiling and smirking about how much better Tories they can be than the Tories. And this comes within 24 hours of Keir Starmer at, I'm not sure if it was town hall or something similar to that, where he's standing up, he's got his sleeves rolled up and he's not wearing a tie because, of course, you know, that's what a politician does at a town hall to be folksy. And he's saying to people, we are, you know, I don't understand why there's any of this waste. So we're going to get rid of NHS England. There's two layers of bureaucracy. There shouldn't be, I think that's too much. I think actually there should be only one layer of bureaucracy. And then eventually we should just sell it off to the Americans. So there's this really frightening thing that they've come out and been more extreme than I think the pessimistic people have been. They are selling off by, you know, dismantling it, essentially, NHS England. Now, the way that the National Health Service works in the UK, to my understanding, is that they do have these subdivisions, right? Because they are technically separate countries in a United Kingdom. So, and then there is a certain amount of devolution with their parliaments, right? You know, Holyrood is separate to Westminster, even though, you know, in practical terms, kind of not really. And what he's saying is, oh, this is all going to just be one NHS. We're getting rid of this double layer of bureaucracy. Now, the real difficulty with that is that by bringing it together and cohesively solidifying it, and by saying that our solution is to make these extreme changes to how the NHS operates, what he's effectively doing is making it ripe for corporatization, which then makes it into one neat little tightly bow-wrapped package to sell off to the Americans or to anybody else, right? Privatization. This is a significant step towards it, the abolition of an entire wing of the NHS, and just saying everybody else is going to pick up the slack for this. This is going to be one unified organization and department that's ripe and ready for corporatizing under the kind of SOE system. This is what I would suspect is going to be the pathway, because that's been the pathway in New Zealand, right? Like the first step is making it into one effective company, like a firm. It's just owned by the government, and then you're able to just sell it. So this is a much darker turn, much more quickly than I think anybody had thought might happen, except for the most pessimistic people. I was surprised by this. They just came out and said it. And he crowed about this and said that this was a big achievement that they're going to have for their government. It's difficult to see in tandem with both how they are attacking disabled people by forcing them into work when they are physically incapable of working. In other words, you know, they'll have no income, no benefits, and will just starve and die. In tandem again with moving towards assisted dying, right? And this is not that I'm against it in principle, but in the context of where they are attacking disabled people and where euthanization would be preferable to just going out, right? All of these confluent factors are coming together with this abolition of NHS England in a way that is not so much worrying as we are waiting for the clock to tick down to mass death and to privatization of the health service.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's in some ways quite a smart play from the right, i.e. the Labour Party fucking Minister of Health, right, Wes Streeting, because when
Oh,
NHS
you have to hand it to Wes Streeting?
on this, I mean, actually, it's not really handing it to them because it's an easy mode. I've handed it to David Seymour because he, you know, he's fought up. He's a battler, right? He's a Kiwi battler who's done much harder graft than Wes Streeting ever has in his entire life. I just mean because there was a left case against separating these NHSs, right? In 2012 or whenever the Tories restructured the NHS to not be under the direct control of the whoever it is, inspected of health or whatever it is, and devolved it into like having these different NHSs. That was seen at the time as increasing bureaucracy in a way that would depersonalize the inevitable cuts, because it was post GFC and it was George Osborne was in full slash and burn mode, right? So there's still a lot of resentment in, as far as I know, again, not an expert, from unions and health workers in the UK around that restructure. So getting rid of that on paper could be seen as a progressive move, right? Or, you know, not literally progressive, but regressing to a more socialist version of the NHS. But I totally agree, Simone, like in the context of the, you know, lethal cuts to disability standards and the crazy shit that he's saying around involving private hands in, which you have to remember, it's a different context, right? The UK's positive nationalism around their NHS is something that in Aotearoa we don't really have for our public sector systems. Like, it's much more of a third rail than we have for really anything in New Zealand. So I think it's much more significant that he's been doing these other kind of unrelated discursive attacks on that system and saying in a kind of, you know, tear the, you know, cut the grass, pull the snakes from the long grass, tear up the trees by the root kind of revolutionary zealotry. That's pretty not just concerning, but I think indicative of like a brutally right-wing revanchist approach to this stuff, which, you know, was, there were indications there, but you're right, it's gone further faster than even the, you know, kind of black-pilled leftists who were in the Green Party were saying at the time in the UK. Yeah, so I totally agree. Like, the problem is, I think the headline, there are two layers to it, right? The headline of NHS England disestablished is misleading for people who don't know that NHS England isn't what the NHS is. It's a bureaucratic structure. And then within that, the purpose of that, right? As you're saying, like, people who know New Zealand history from the 80s and 90s, it will have a lingering kind of hatred for the SOE concept. Hopefully, right, if you've got some sensibility. And I think a lot of people on the centre right kind of do as well. Like, New Zealand First voters start frothing at the mouth if they talk about SOEs, right? And the way that we destroyed public capacity to do stuff and corporatisation as opposed to companies. But corporatisation as a process lost us as a country billions and billions and billions of dollars of work and pipeline and capacity and all that big picture post Muldoonian stuff, right? That was on balance probably better to have than not have. And the, you know, that Labour and then National and then Labour governments really just saw through that process to like an incredibly disastrous degree. And that does look kind of like what Labour in the UK's after here. And it's horrible. It's horrible that they're on that path, especially in this geopolitical context, right? To go back to what we were talking about before, is there a better time than now to become more kind of self-reliant? And the NHS is exactly what you need right now, because Lord knows Pfizer's not going to come in and do a better job than a homegrown company when it comes to delivery of primary healthcare or whoever it is, right? Any of the big kind of bio tech medicinal pharma fucking monsters are not going to do a better job than something run by government.
And finally, the TPPA will come into action. something we've
Finally.
forgotten about. That's right. Yeah, I mean, I think hit the nail on the head that, in respect of comms, that the danger of it is that they've played it very well where somebody can say, oh no, they're abolishing the NHS, and then they can say, ah, that's not correct, in fact XYZ, and then that blunts any criticism, right? Because then people will go away and say, oh well, they're not doing anything, but they don't understand the context and what is happening under Starmerism here. And this is not to say, as I say, you know, the kind of the splitting, the bureaucratization that's occurred is some kind of positive development, but rather that the purpose for rolling it back and what's coming out of that is the concern. So that's it.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, in a similar way, the same argument was made in New Zealand, right? When the in the SOE process, there was an argument for centralization, and when, you know, in a post you know, early neoliberal phase, people were saying, oh, the efficiencies of competition and the efficiencies of companies and the profit motive and all this good sounding stuff that the Douglases of this world, right, were going on about. Roger Douglases were excited by this stuff. But then the antidote, what was seen as the antidote to that, and then was then immediately betrayed, was this kind of centralized corporatization. It wasn't a joint socialist or communal vision for what's better for the country, for public good. It was bureaucratically centralizing as opposed to centralizing with some values, with a kind of masthead to work towards a singular goal. So then, as Simone was saying, you can, you know, you can bring these functions together and then more efficiently sell them off, or, you know, parcel them up. It's an appealing kind of appetizer to a foreign investment company, venture capitalists coming in. To go back to our kind of invest in infrastructure summit chat, these people come in, they kind of look down the books. Is this, you know, are you in the red? Are you in the black? How's it looking? And they go, oh yeah, you know, this, in those days it was like telecommunications, but in the UK, it could be like, oh, what, you know, what profit can we extract from keeping people alive or choosing not to, right?
Yeah.
What medicines can we provide more cheaply than you?
It reminds me of when, what was it? They were selling off, flogging off the rails. And I forget the specifics of the story. Hopefully someone will remember or will acknowledge that this isn't just a hallucination. But this is like an anecdote that's told as like proof of private ingenuity, where I think it was KiwiRail sold the rights to the berms or something of their rail lines to someone who immediately laid like telecommunications cables along it, which, like, fine, okay, that generated them a bit of profit because they connected all these cables and stuff. But it's sort of like, well, ideally I would want my railways to have trains on them going back and forth and not like be flogged off for like small, in the States, for example, where they're just trying to flog off all the postal infrastructure, because that's what they see as the value of it, is that it's got all these buildings, it's got all this prime real estate. Why are we supporting this like increasingly expensive like postal service when there's like private competition and all that? And it's like an undervaluing of like the public good of that infrastructure, of that service. Sorry if that was a weird digression.
No, totally. Because it is, it's both an undervaluing of the public good and just a lack of political imagination, right? Like in New Zealand now, we talk about, oh, why couldn't people have had more, you know, more of an ability to plan for the future? We think about that when it comes to health, like we don't have enough hospitals, but we should have built some 30 years ago, not today. And we talk about it in education and we talk about it in infrastructure, you know, why can't Simone get to work in Hamilton on a fast train? Why does she have to wait fucking 2.5 hours to commute from a city to another city that's relatively pretty bloody close, right?
Yeah, why? Actually, the train... No. I should point out, I have to drive, which I don't like, partly for the fossil fuels and partly because then you have to concentrate, right? And then you have to be in Auckland traffic with Auckland drivers. And the thing is, because the train doesn't actually run the reverse on time to get to work. It's even worse than that. We just don't have the services. They don't exist. You know, we're sort of England in miniature. It's awful. All I was going to say is just I think PMAX is totally right. You know, one of the, it's almost darkly funny that New Zealand like privatized telecom just before the internet happened. Just like, this is one of the stupidest possible moves you could make. World historic levels of idiocy, right? Except that, you know, it's of course calculated, you know, for all of this. You know, if you were looking at it objectively as a use case, you'd be like, you know, it's bad. But in respect of the corporatization thing, when you allow the kind of ideology of business to determine government, apart from the fact that, you know, we have a country that's run by a CEO, so we already have that already. In England, they, you know, they don't quite have that. That although you can't predict the future, I think it is likely that one of the lines they may run will be, we have looked at the books, because of course now, you know, NHS has to run like a corporation. And in fact, oh my gosh, it's in the red constantly. You know, we must do something to alleviate this kind of burden on the government. And wouldn't it be stripped down and sleeker if we allowed these great, amazing American companies to do X, Y, and Z? You know, that once you say, oh, we're talking about the books, we're opening the books, this mythology built around it that we can, you know, tell people who've, you know, been propagandized by viewing the nightly news every night where they talk about how the stock is going up or down, even though they don't own any stocks, you know, just the kind of ideological effect of that, that they'll not necessarily buy it hook, line, and sinker, but there seems to be some kind of plausibility around it when you frame it that way. And I think that that is one of the likely lines that they'll run. But it's difficult to say or know exactly how they're going to play this out. We can look at the New Zealand experience, as PMAX pointed out, and see how this has been done in the past and what the tactics are. But we don't live in England, so, you know.
And just thinking on a longer term time frame, right? Like, my concern is that we live in a world where Hipkins is visiting Starmer to take lessons about how to win elections, and Starmer isn't reading about New Zealand history to see what happens when you corporatize massive, you know, for better or for worse, pretty necessary economic institutions that deliver the necessities of everyday life. Like, there are some lessons that I think the UK Labour Party needs to be learning too. But, you know, I'm not naive enough to think that he doesn't know these things. I'm black-pilled enough to think that he does.
Departments that are actioning deliverables.
Oh, gotta love a deliverable, right? Okay, let's wrap.
Taking
let's
some
wrap
learnings then. Away.
Oh, God, the L word, I hate it. All right, let's wrap. Let's wrap, team. PMAX, do you have a final word or a plug?
No final words or plugs beyond just, like, shit's fucking rough.
Delight. Simone.
Oh, do I have a final word? Boo!
That's good. That's a good final word.
That's a great final word, yeah. I don't have that much more. Yeah, I don't know if I should plug, because, you know, when people follow me from 1 of 200, they're like, oh, this isn't politics, this is just gay. And I'm like, yeah, hello. I didn't tell
sure
you to follow me.
What you were getting, yes.
And or like really, really just stupid jokes about like anime or something. I don't know.
I think it's fair that, look, if you're a listener, whether long or short term to this podcast, if you follow any of the individuals in this podcast, you're going to get very different vibes from what you get when we've got our Saturday morning voices on. It's fine. PMAX, Simone, and myself, Philip. That's been another week of current events. We'll catch you next time. Bye bye.
If artifices are denied, live in a pointless life, but learning all your lessons, fucking politics is no distinction. The words upon now is paid with good intentions. And I'll admit that I'm at a loss for what to say when they criticize a cost me ought to stay. Cause I live amongst the people every day.